program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Science Journal, an audio journal production presenting articles of interest from science magazines, newspapers, and online resources on topics such as technology, health, and the environment. Material selected with the interest of its audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, the board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. This program is supported in part by Cognex and UMass Medical School. Our program today will bring you articles from Science News, Popular Science, Science Alert, BBC Sky, and others. This is David Jaffe, and I'll start with, do you love sleeping with your pet? Science reveals there's a tricky trade-off. From Popular Science, April 8th, 2026. For some pet guardians, their pets are present in their lives from the moment they wake up to the moment they go to bed. This happens because cats, dogs, and other companion animals are increasingly perceived as family members. I'm not talking about distant cousin, for example, but the ones who really take part in our everyday lives. In some cases, this includes quieter, more intimate moments like bedtime. Sleeping with your cat or dog can feel comforting, even essential. In fact, according to a survey conducted by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, almost half, 46%, of respondents sleep in the same bed with a pet. As a clinical researcher that focuses on the interactions between pet owners and their animals, I work with many people who describe a close relationship with their pets and share a variety of moments with them. The benefits of this bond are supported by science. Research shows daily interactions with pets can enhance well-being. But research also suggests that any potential benefits to sleeping next to a beloved pet aren't straightforward and can feel comforting even as it may quietly disrupt sleep quality. The emotional logic of co-sleeping with pets. The impact of co-sleeping can be measured through self-reports and questionnaires, as well as with objective tools like wristwatches that measure what's happening physiologically during the night. In studies using subjective measures, many pet guardians report sleeping better when their pets are with them. Other benefits linked with co-sleeping include an increase in feelings of comfort and emotional safety. In this context, sleeping places us in a state of perceived vulnerability. Sleeping with a pet, particularly one with whom we have a close bond, may reduce this sense of vulnerability while enhancing a sense of safety. Emotional regulation is another possible mechanism in this context, as feeling safer can lower emotional arousal. In other words, the presence of a pet may simply help pet guardians feel safe and comfortable. Waking up with a pet next to them can bring a sense of happiness, which may lead them to feel they slept well. At the same time, some studies using standard questionnaires to assess insomnia and sleep quality suggest that co-sleeping with a pet is not linked to lower stress and may increase insomnia and reduce perceived sleep quality. These mixed findings suggest that the effects of co-sleeping are more complex than they may seem, that how we feel about our sleep doesn't always match what's happening in our body. Co-sleeping from a physiological perspective. We can also investigate the impacts of co-sleeping with pets more objectively, using tools to assess sleep patterns, awakenings during the night, and overall sleep quality. Research suggests that even when pet guardians report better sleep, physiological measures often show more fragmented sleep when they share the bed with their pets. In one study, researchers used a wristwatch-like device to measure people's movement during the night while they slept with their pets. They found that even when people felt they slept well, their sleep tended to be more disrupted. In some cases, these disruptions were related to the pet's movements during the night. Researchers observed a synchrony in which pets' movements influenced their guardian's movement patterns and vice versa. Co-sleeping with a pet, therefore, may affect both the person's sleep and the pet's sleep. And though these disruptions aren't uniform, they may depend on the type of animal you share your bed. Why dogs disrupt sleep more than cats? There's also evidence that the impact may vary depending on the type and number of pets. People who sleep with dogs may experience more disruption, while those sleeping with cats often report mixed results. Although the reasons for these differences are unclear, they may be linked to dogs' greater sensitivity to external stimuli, such as car noise, barking in the neighborhood, and other environmental sounds. Considering how these experiences can shape mental health and well-being, it's important to note that poor sleep quality over time can impact emotional regulation. This may appear as lower tolerance for frustration or a reduced ability to manage emotionally challenging situations. Fatigue, depressed mood, difficulty focusing, and a range of other symptoms may also be linked to poor sleep. Taken together, these findings challenge the idea that co-sleeping is simply either good or bad. Rethinking the good or bad debate. Sleeping with a pet seems to be both comforting and disruptive at the same time. It is a complex behavior, and understanding people's motivations behind whether they share their bed is important. In some cases, for example, co-sleeping with a pet can be very meaningful, aligned with people's needs, and potentially linked to comfort and well-being. At the same time, it's important to keep in mind that our perceptions do not always fully reflect what is happening in the body. From a practical perspective, a more nuanced understanding of co-sleeping can shed light on how it shapes daily experiences, sleep, and overall health. Closer attention to how pets are integrated into our lives can help guardians make decisions about that consider both physical and mental health without neglecting the potential impacts of those decisions on the pet. Rather than asking whether co-sleeping with your pet is beneficial or harmful, a better question is, are you prioritizing emotional comfort or uninterrupted sleep? Recognizing the trade-off can help pet guardians make an informed choice. The strange reasons 99.999% of the ocean floor remains unexplored. March 7, 2026 from BBC Science Focus magazine. The ocean is unbelievably large and hard to navigate, but are we any nearer to understanding it? With a telescope and a clear night, anyone can get a good idea of what the moon looks like, at least on the side facing towards us. What's more, the moon is around 10 times smaller than the deep sea floor, which covers two-thirds of the entire surface of the Earth. That huge area, more than 335 million square kilometers, or around 129.3 million square miles, together with the deep's inaccessibility far offshore, explains why, even with all the technologies now available, scientists have explored only a tiny fraction of the deep sea floor. Recently, a team of scientists put together a global dive data set containing information from around 44,000 dives into the deep. These were carried out by scientists inside submersibles, as well as remotely operated vehicles, ROVs, and autonomous robots that steer themselves. Collectively, these deep submergence vehicles, as they're known, filmed and photographed an area equal to less than 0.001% of the deep sea floor. That's roughly the same as Rhode Island, the smallest U.S. state. If the same statistics applied to land-based exploration, all we'd know about terrestrial ecosystems would have come from an area roughly the size of Greater London. To make matters worse, the minuscule portion of the seafloor that people have explored is an immensely biased sample of the entire deep sea. 65% of the exploratory dives into the deep have taken place within 200 nautical miles of either the U.S., Japan, or New Zealand. And almost all observations of the deep sea floor, around 97%, were carried out by those three countries plus France and Germany. What's more, explorers have for the most part been focusing on a very narrow range of the deep sea features. Masses of research effort has been channeled towards exploring the craggy seascapes of deep canyons and escarpments, glossing over the other geological elements like the vast abysmal plains. Another limitation to deep sea exploration, revealed by the Global Dive dataset, is depth. Over the decades, while the number of dives per year has increased, they've been going ever shallower. Back in the 1960s, more than half of the dives went deeper than 2 kilometers down, around 1.2 miles. But by the 2010s, only a quarter of dives were going that far beneath the waves. And that's a big problem, because the majority of the ocean, around 75%, lies between 2 kilometers and 6 kilometers below sea level, 1.2 to 3.7 miles. It's clear that modern-day deep-sea explorers are missing an awful lot of the seafloor. Most countries are not involved in deep-sea exploration, and most regions of the deep remain completely unseen and unknown. Efforts are now underway to fix that by making deep-sea tools more accessible and less expensive, and by directing dives toward lesser-known sites to help find out what actually is down on the deep sea floor all around the world. Gladys West, mathematician whose work paved the way for GPS, dies at 95. From NPR, January 23, 2026. She navigated segregation to become an esteemed mathematician, and today her work helps billions of people navigate the world. Gladys West, whose pioneering career contributed key elements to what became the GPS satellite system and was later acknowledged as a hidden figure of GPS, died Saturday at age 95. West passed peacefully alongside her family and friends and is now in heaven with her loved ones, her family said as they announced her death. West is credited with astounding accomplishments in mathematics, playing pivotal roles in charting orbital trajectories and creating accurate mathematical models of the Earth's shape that would eventually be used by the GPS satellite orbit. But, as West admitted to member station VPM in 2020, she did not really rely on the groundbreaking system she helped create. "I would say minimal," she replied when asked if she used GPS. "I prefer maps. A commitment to be the best I could be." Born Gladys May Brown in 1930, West grew up in the Jim Crow era on a small farm in Dinwiddie County, Virginia, south of Richmond. She attended a one-room schoolhouse with one teacher, and in her memoir, It Began with a Dream, West wrote of the aspirations that grew during those early years. "Every day I wished and dreamed of having more books, more classrooms, more teachers, and more time to dream and imagine what life would be like if only I could fly away from the strenuous and seemingly never-ending work on our family farm." Realizing that education could open doors to a new life, West added, "I made a commitment to be the best I could be and absorb as much knowledge that a little farm girl could handle." As she neared graduation in her segregated high school, teachers urged her to pursue a degree in mathematics. "If you had left it to me, I would have majored in home economics," she told VPM. "I really did like geometry," she added. "I fell in love with that." But first, West, daughter of farmers who also worked jobs in tobacco factory and for the railroad, would have to figure out a path to attending college. When she learned that the top senior in her high school was guaranteed a scholarship to college, she was motivated to earn that spot and successfully became valedictorian of her class. According to a profile of West in notices of the American Mathematical Society, West used that scholarship to attend Virginia State College, an HBCU, now known as Virginia State University, where she studied math and joined the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. She then taught math and science in segregated schools in Virginia, earning her master's degree in 1955, the same year President Dwight Eisenhower banned racial discrimination and federal hiring. Seeing limitations and opportunities to overcome them. 1 year later, West was offered a job in Dahlgren, Virginia, at the Naval Proving Ground, which later became the Naval Surface Warfare Center, Dahlgren Division. "There were three other black professionals," West recalled to VPM. "We were respectful to the leaders and tried to treat them the way we wanted them to treat us if we were in the same position. One of the other professionals was Ira West, a mathematician. The pair married in 1957. I met her at a lunch break," Ira West told VPM in 2020, recalling what his future wife was wearing, a pleated blue skirt and a white blouse. "When I first saw her, I knew there was something for me," he said, "but she didn't know there was something for her in looking at me." The couple had three children and seven grandchildren. Ira West died in 2024. Gladys West worked at the Naval Program for 42 years. In a 2021 interview, she said two things helped her cope with the limitations imposed by racism. She enjoyed her work, and she wanted more black people to get a chance to do it. "I always felt reasonably responsible for being the best and doing the best that I could," she told the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, adding that by setting a positive example, she hoped to undermine discrimination. "I always felt that I would give my best regardless of what was going on, to give my best of myself because I just respected myself that well." Massive computers produced modeling data used for GPS. West's work grew in tandem with enormous gains in computing. She began her career at a time when cutting-edge computing meant that researchers' ideas had to be coded as zeros and ones, punched out on cards, and fed into massive machines. Sometimes they'd call you to see if you wanted to watch it, to see whether it blows up or not. West told notices of the American Mathematical Society in 2020. She added, that was old time. It's much easier now. Here's how the Department of Defense sums up some of West's pivotal work. In the early 1960s, she participated in an award-winning astronomical study that proved the regularity of Pluto's motion relative to Neptune. From the mid-70s through the 1980s, West used complex algorithms to account for variations in gravitational, tidal, and other forces that distort Earth's shape. She programmed the IBM 7030 computer, also known as STRETCH, to deliver increasingly refined calculations for an extremely accurate model of the Earth's shape, optimized for what ultimately became the GPS orbit used by satellites. Without her work and updates that came later, the intricately accurate navigation and timing of GPS would not have been possible, according to the U.S. Space Force. A hidden figure no more. For most of her life, West's abilities and achievements were not widely known. Similar to other black women doing pivotal work in science and math during the Cold War and highlighted in the 2016 book Hidden Figures. But West received notable recognitions over the past decade, including the military's Space and Missile Pioneers Hall of Fame in 2018 and the National Museum of the Surface Navy's Freedom of the Seas Exploration and Innovation Award in 2023. She also became the first woman to win the Prince Philip Medal, awarded by the UK's Royal Academy of Engineering. Speaking to VPM in 2020, West offered advice for young people facing adversity. You can give up and cause a whole lot of stress on yourself, or you can take what you have and make the best of it, she said. Do your best work, work hard, all the kinds of things that make you feel proud, and be a real good person. Despite the struggles of her childhood and the effects of racism on her career, West said she believes she accomplished all she could. I'm pretty satisfied that I used myself up, she said with a smile. Scientist turns people's mental images into text using mind captioning technology from Science by Amarachi Ori, November 14, 2025. A scientist in Japan has developed a technique that uses brain scans and artificial intelligence to turn a person's mental images into accurate descriptive sentences. While there has been progress in using scans of brain activity to translate the words we think into text, turning our complex mental images into language has proved challenging, according to Tomoyasu Harakawa, author of a study published November 5th in the journal Science Advances. However, Harakawa's new method, known as mind captioning, works by using AI to generate descriptive text that mirrors information in the brain about visual details such as objects, places, actions, and events, as well as the relationships between them. Horikawa, a researcher at the telecommunication company NTTS, Communications Science Laboratories, just outside Tokyo, began by analyzing the brain activity of four men and two women, native Japanese speakers, between 22 and 37 years old, scanning their brains as they watched video clips. The participants viewed 2,180 videos without sound that were seconds long and varied in content among objects, scenes, and actions. Large language models, generative AI systems trained on large datasets, took captions of the video clips and turned those captions into sequences of numbers. Harakawa trained separate, simpler AI models, known as decoders, to match the scanned brain activity related to the video clips to the numerical sequences. He then used the decoders to interpret the study participants' brain activity while they watched or recalled videos that the AI had not encountered during the training process. Another algorithm was created to progressively generate word sequences that best matched the decoded brain activity. As the AI learned from the data, the descriptive text tool became better and better at using the brain scans to describe the videos the participants had watched. It's just one additional step forward in the direction of what, in my view, we can legitimately call brain reading or mind reading, Marcello Iannecca, a a professor of ethics of AI and neuroscience at Technical University of Munich in Germany, and president-elect of the International Neuroethics Society, told CNN he was not involved in the study. Potential for profound health interventions. The AI model generated text in English, even though the participants were not native English speakers. The method can create comprehensive descriptions of visual content, even without using the activity in language-related regions of the brain, or the language network, Arakawa said, indicating that this method can be used even when someone has damage around the language network. The technology could potentially be used to assist people with aphasia who struggle with language expression due to damage around the language network, or amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, a progressive neurodegenerative disease that affects speech, according to the study. I think the study paves the way for some profound interventions for people who have difficulty communicating, including nonverbal autistic people, said psychologist Scott Barry Kaufman, a lecturer at Barnard College in New York who was not involved in the study. However, we have to use it carefully and make sure we aren't being invasive and that everyone consents to it, he told CNN. The ultimate privacy challenge. The success of this method, which could be applied to decode the thoughts of infants or animals or the content of dreams, raises ethical concerns regarding privacy, with the possibility of disclosing an individual's private thoughts before they have verbalized them, the study noted. If in the future this technology is used by consumers beyond biomedical purposes, I think this is the ultimate privacy challenge, Ayanka said. He added that there are many companies, such as Neuralink, Elon Musk's brain implant startup, that are making public claims about soon developing neural implants for the general population. If we get there, then we need to have a very, very strict rules when it comes to granting access to people's minds and brains, Ayanka said, highlighting that our brains include sensitive information, such as signatures of early dementia and psychiatric disorders and depression. A study published in the journal Cell in August suggested that the leakage of private inner thoughts during decoding could be prevented by a mechanism in which the user thinks of a particular keyword to unlock the decoding tool only when intended. The neuroscience is moving fast and the assistive potential is huge, but mental privacy and freedom of thought protections can't wait, said social scientist Lukas Zuskowitz, an assistant professor at the Adam Mickiewicz University in Poland and a director of European affairs at the Neuro Rights Foundation in New York. We should treat neural data as sensitive by default, require explicit purpose-limited consent, and prioritize on-device processing with user-controlled unlock mechanisms. Reliance on AI introduces additional regulatory and cybersecurity challenges and underscores the need for complementary AI-specific legal framework, Zuskowitz, who was not involved in the study, told CNN. However, Arakawa noted that the method used in his study requires a large amount of data collection with the cooperation of active participants. So, while the technology is useful for neuroscientific research, it is not so accurate for practical use, he said. Also, the videos used in the study included typical scenes of, for example, a dog biting a man, but not more unusual scenes, say a man biting a dog. Therefore, it is not yet clear whether the technique could be used to capture less predictable mental images. As a result, while some people may worry that this technology poses serious risk to mental privacy, in reality, the current approach cannot easily read a person's private thoughts, Arakawa said. The Green River flows uphill. Geologists think they finally know why. Popular Science by Andrew Paul, published February 2, 2026. The Colorado River tributary in northeastern Utah has baffled geologists for 150 years. The Green River doesn't make a lot of sense at first glance. The Colorado River's largest tributary flows through a nearly 2,300-foot deep canyon inside of northeastern's Uinta Mountain. But at least 2.5 miles high, the massive 50-million-year-old rock formation hypothetically shouldn't have even yielded to the nearby Green River, which itself began to form less than 8 million years ago. After examining a combination of seismic imaging and data modeling scenarios, an international research team now believes that they can explain this longtime mystery behind one of North America's most prominent river systems. Water typically follows the path of least resistance. If a stream encounters an immovable object, such as a large rock, fluid physics dictates that it simply follows both gravity and inertia towards an easier route forward. This isn't to say that water isn't powerful in its own ways. Some of the world's largest canyons were carved by comparatively small currents over millions of years. But even then, their winding trails typically follow a uniform logic. This makes the story of how the Green and Colorado rivers met so perplexing to geologists like Adam Smith at Scotland's University of Glasgow. According to the co-author of his team's study, published on February 2nd in the Journal of Geophysical Research, Earth's Surface, the region is enormously significant to the overall landmass. The merging of the Green and Colorado rivers millions of years ago altered the continental divide of North America, he explained in a statement. It created the line that separates the rivers that flow into the Pacific from those that flow into the Atlantic, and created new habitat boundaries for wildlife that influenced their evolution. Geologists like Smith have already debated about the river merger for around 150 years. It's a particularly vexing subject, given the area's tectonic inactivity and lack of major geological events. However, researchers have recently begun analyzing a novel concept known as lithospheric drip. This phenomenon begins when a dense layer of mineral-rich substances forms at the base of the crust. Over time, the layer grows heavy enough to sink into the mantle. When this happens, the descent can also tug on the land above it and even lower a mountain range like Uinta. Eventually, the mineral layer breaks away and continues to sink further into the mantle. The mountains then appear to bounce back in its wake, and in the process forms a bullseye-like region in the landscape. Smith and collaborators relied on seismic imaging to locate evidence of lithospheric drip in Utah. This technique works like a CT scan of the Earth to analyze the seismic waves created during earthquakes. While reviewing previously published seismic image studies of the Uinta Mountains, the team spotted a comparatively cold, round space about 125 miles below the Earth's surface, with a diameter measuring 31 to 22 miles across. They now believe this discovery is an ancient, broken fragment of a drip. We think that we've gathered enough evidence to show that lithospheric drip is responsible for pulling the land down enough to enable the rivers to link and merge, Smith said. Given the likely speed of descent and its current depth, the study's authors estimate the drip broke away 2 to 5 million years ago. This timeline corresponds to previous work suggesting the Green River carved into the mountains and joined with the larger Colorado system. Geological modeling further confirmed their hypothesis. After measuring the Uinta Mountains with the graphic drip bullseye pattern, they discovered the underlying crust is many miles thinner than it should be given the range's height. A final calculation of surface rebounding for these drips parameters aligned with their estimates of the river network's more than 1,312-foot fluctuation in elevation. The evidence we've collected strongly contradicts the idea that the river predated the mountains, or that sediment deposits might have built up enough of the river to overtop the range, or that erosion from the south of the mountains captured the Green River, said Smith. The study's authors believe their theory doesn't only answer a multi-generational mystery, it provides a template for applying lithographic drip analysis to many other lingering tectonic debates around the world. Ex-Google boss may launch a bigger-than-Hubble space telescope within 3 years. Are we about to get a new, privately funded space observatory? From BBC Sky at Night magazine, March 7, 2026. When YERK's observatory opened in Wisconsin in 1897, it was a wonder. Alongside the great 1-meter, 40-inch telescope, the largest refractor ever built, the lavish facilities included the novelty of chemical and physical laboratories to support the new science of astrophysics. All this scientific largesse was the gift of Charles Yerkes, a tycoon with a fortune derived in part from building bits of the London Underground. Private support of even the grandest cutting-edge facilities was the norm, and only after the Second World War did telescopes, and later space missions like Hubble, become so expensive that government support was essential. Today's marvels, from JWST to the Vera Rubin Observatory, are funded mostly by taxes allocated to science agencies. That's just the way it has to be, or does it? The new private space telescope. The new space telescope has been announced, Lazuli, with a 3-meter, 10-foot mirror capable of observing in the optical and infrared. This makes it larger than Hubble and will fly a sophisticated spectrograph and camera, plus a coronagraph for spotting planets around nearby stars. What's really notable is that the entire cost of Lazuli is being covered by Eric and Wendy Schmidt. Eric used to run Google, and they're writing a check for what must easily be hundreds of millions of dollars. The paper claims the team can move faster than a space agency by accepting more risk and using technologies, particularly in camera design, that haven't yet been proven to work in space. Lazuli could be flying, they say, in 3 to 5 years. What Lazuli could find. By then, astronomers will be swimming in alerts for transient events, supernova, nova, and other short-lived phenomena from the Vera Rubin Observatory and gravitational wave observatories. While Hubble, say, needs at least a few days' notice to swing to a new target, Lazuli will respond to new alerts in under 4 hours, perhaps even within 90 minutes. If Lazuli can swing into action so quickly, it'll play a big role in understanding the formation and evolution of black holes and other exotic objects. It may even help with the Hubble tension crisis in cosmology, where current methods for measuring the speed of expansion of the universe disagree slightly, but significantly. The onboard spectroscope is important. Rapidly capturing the spectra of transients like 8C201, 8COW, a bright, fast-charging explosion caught a few years back, might explain why they remain surprisingly bright in the infrared so long after their initial explosion. Spectroscopy of exoplanet atmospheres makes use of the 3-meter mirror, and it will help us understand what these new worlds are like. The coronagraph will allow the discovery of planets in Jupiter-like orbits around nearby stars, paving the way for the next really big taxpayer-funded space telescope, the Habitable Worlds Observatory, which will do the same for the worlds in Earth-like orbits. The Roman Space Telescope, due for launch this year, does have a similar instrument on board, but Lazuli's slightly larger mirror, aided by a design that stops the secondary mirror from blocking the primary, has a slight advantage. It's very exciting. If the accelerated schedule is achieved and the risk-taking pays off, astronomers in almost every field will have cause to celebrate a remarkable act of generosity. Why do animals have spots and stripes? Zebras' stripes and leopards' spots are perfectly imperfect. By Laura Basis, published October 27, 2025, Popular Science. The fur and scales of the animal kingdom are far from boring and full of wild colors and patterns. These mathematically inspired designs, like leopard spots and tiger stripes, are as interesting as they are intricate. But how did animals get their spots, stripes, and everything in between? It's a question that has puzzled scientists and mathematicians for decades. But one group might be closer to an answer. A puzzle even a famous codebreaker couldn't crack. In 1952, British mathematician Alan Turing hypothesized that as tissue develops, it generates chemical agents that move about, similar to how white milk spreads when it is poured into black coffee. In Turing's theory, some of these chemicals then activate pigment-producing cells, which creates spots. Other chemicals will stop these cells, creating the blank spaces in between them. However, computer simulations based on Turing's idea created spots that were blurrier than those found in nature. In 2023, University of Colorado at Boulder chemical engineer Ankur Gupta and his collaborators improved upon Turing's theory by adding another mechanism called diffusion photosynthesis. This is a process where diffusing particles pull other particles along with them. It's similar to how dirty clothes are cleaned in the laundry. As the soap dispenses out of the clothing and into the water, it drags dirt and grime away from the fabric. Gupta turned to the purple and black hexagon pattern seen on ornate boxfish, a bright species found off the coast of Australia, as a test. He found that diffusio photosynthesis could generate patterns with sharper outlines than Turing's original model, but these results were just a little too perfect. All of the hexagons were still the same size and shape and had identical spaces between them. In nature, no pattern is perfect. For example, a zebra's black stripes vary in thickness, while hexagons on the boxfish are never perfectly uniform. So Gupta and the team sought out to refine their diffusio photosynthesis theory. Imperfections are everywhere in nature, Gupta said in a statement. We proposed a simple idea that can explain how cells assemble to create these variations. In a study published today in the journal Matter, Gupta and the team detail how they were able to mimic the imperfect patterns and texture. After giving individual cells defined sizes and then modeling how each one moved through tissue, the simulations began to make less uniform patterns. It's similar to how balls of different sizes would move through a tube. The larger ones, like a basketball or bowling ball, would create thicker outlines than golf balls or ping pong balls. It's the same with cells. When bigger cells cluster, they make broader patterns. If the same balls traveling in a tube bump into one another and clog it, it'll break up a continuous line. When cells experience that same traffic jam, the result is the breaks in the stripes. We're able to capture these imperfections and textures simply by giving these cells a size, Gupta said. Their new simulations showed breaks and grainy textures that are now more similar to those found in nature. Why it matters. In the future, the team plans to use more complex interactions among cells and background chemical agents to improve the accuracy of their simulations. Understanding how pattern-making cells assemble could help engineers develop materials that can change colors based on their environment in a way that a chameleon's skin does. It may also help create more effective approaches for delivering medicine to a specific part of the body. We are drawing inspiration from the imperfect beauty of a natural system and hope to harness these imperfections for new kinds of functionality in the future, Gupta said. It's illegal to pump your own gas in New Jersey, but why? The Garden State's decades-old law is rooted in safety, science, and jobs, but how risky is pumping your own fuel? By Laura Kinnery, published April 9, 2026, in Popular Science. I had a confession to make. In my late teens, my car ran out of gas along the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Rather than pump my own gas in Pennsylvania, I'd been trying to make it across to neighboring New Jersey, a state that's notoriously known for prohibiting self-service at gas stations on an almost empty tank. The truth is, I had no idea how to fill a tank on my own. Since Oregon softened its laws back in 2023, New Jersey remains the only U.S. state in which drivers are not allowed to pump their own gas. Those of us from the Garden State often find the entire process of fueling up intimidating. So much so that we're willing to run on fumes rather than work on the pumps ourselves. My experience on the Pennsylvania Turnpike was a learning one for sure, but it left me with questions. In order to tackle some of those questions, we at Popular Science asked both Dr. Michael Jarrett, a professor at the Department of Environmental Health Sciences at UCLA, and Thomas Wright, a spokesperson for the New Jersey Department of Labor and Workforce Development, to weigh in on New Jersey's unusual law and the science behind it. The origins of New Jersey's ban on self-service. While the first dedicated drive-in gas station opened in Missouri in 1905, it took until the 1970s for most states to switch over to self-service. They did so in part due to the rising gas costs resulting from the 1973 energy crisis. Facing tight margins, gas stations realized they could lower their overhead by reducing staff and then pass that savings on to customers. In short, having patrons pump their own gas allowed gas stations to remain competitive. To make the switch, these states had to modify their fire codes. This included installing emergency cutoff switches for all pump stations and heavily regulated latch-open nozzles, those notches that allow you to keep gas flowing without having to hold the nozzle yourself. Two states held out, New Jersey and Oregon, primarily due to the laws they enacted during the mid-20th century, citing safety concerns such as high fire risks and health safety hazards, including exposure to toxic fumes. New Jersey's legislation prohibiting customers from pumping their own gas dates back to 1949. It's known as the Retail Gasoline Dispensing Safety Act. Under New Jersey's law, trained attendants rather than customers handle the dispensing of fuel, as they are required to know where emergency shutoffs are, recognize potentially unsafe conditions, and ensure that only approved containers are filled, says Wright. The health risks associated with pumping gas. While pumping gas is an act that most people, New Jerseyans excluded, do without thinking, there are health hazards associated with it. Basically, gasoline vapors include benzene, a colorless, sweet-smelling chemical that's highly flammable, says Jarrett, as well as other volatile organic compounds, which are carbon-based chemicals that evaporate into the air at room temperature. These include toluene, ethylbenzene, and xylene, all used to help improve a fuel's efficiency and stability, as well as an engine's performance. All of these flammable, colorless liquids are considered neurotoxic, meaning being exposed to them in large doses can cause headaches, fatigue, and even more severe symptoms like death. But don't get too worried, says Jarrett, since it's the dose that makes the poison. Gas stations nationwide have gone to great lengths to limit our exposure to vapors at the pumps. California, for example, uses rubber sealers around the nozzle for fueling, says Jeffert. These prevent harmful gasoline vapors from escaping into the atmosphere during fueling, which protects not only the people at the gas tank, but also the environment. Wright says that prohibiting self-service also helps with overall general safety measures. When customers pump their own gas, it's simply harder to enforce basic rules like turning off engines or not smoking. Indeed, smoking or vaping both provide ignition sources that can be highly flammable at a gas station. It's the same for vehicles that are left running. Turning off your car's engine prevents heat from the vehicle's exhaust, inadvertently igniting gasoline vapors. There's also static electricity. This buildup of electrical charge, we've all felt that zap, on the surface of an object often happens when you slide onto and off your car seat. This can generate high voltage sparks exceeding 1500 volts, which can easily spark a fire. The best ways to avoid a zap are to not get back into your vehicle while you're filling up and to ground yourself. Try touching a metal part of the car away from the nozzle if you feel a static charge. Limiting your own exposure. For self-serve patrons, there are things you can do to limit your exposure at the pump, says Jarrett. Avoid standing over the nozzle while filling your tank, or use the latch open if it's available and simply walk away. High or wind speeds can disperse vapors more readily, so avoid pumping gas until the weather calms. While fires at gas stations do occur, roughly three-quarters of them result from mechanical or electrical malfunctions, not from pumping gas. In fact, only about 4% of them begin with gasoline igniting, so the chances of starting a fire at the gas station are extremely slim. Still, having a trained attendant pump your gas is generally considered a safer option, since it reduces the risks of vehicles left running, static electricity, and consumers lighting up. It also keeps people who may be at high risk for health complications, such as senior citizens and pregnant women, away from toxic fumes. The benefits of full service. In 2025, New Jersey had more than 1,900 gas stations and roughly 10,000 workers in the auto and watercraft service attendant category, which includes gas station attendants. The law we're tasked with enforcing prioritizes safety, accountability, and job creation, says Wright. Plus, the temperature is often better in the car. Now, if they could just arrange a course in how to pump your own gas for those traveling out of state. Windshield wipers overlooked a female inventor. Mary Anderson patented the device in 1903, only to be told her idea had no commercial value. By Soshi Pax, published March 4, 2026, in Popular Science. Before cars and buses became ubiquitous features of the modern cityscape, many cities installed streetcars to shuttle residents from neighborhood to neighborhood. In the summer months, the journey was a sweltering one, with dozens of sticky, sweaty passengers cramped together in the heat. But winters were worse. The biggest problem wasn't that trolleys were unheated. That advancement came with their electrification in the 1890s. It was that sleet and snow made it impossible for streetcar drivers to see. They had no choice but to either hang their heads out on open window or to stop completely every few blocks to manually clean the glass from the outside. The frigid air rushed in either way. Businesswoman Mary Anderson had never experienced public transportation's seasonal struggle back home in Birmingham, Alabama. But shivering in a streetcar during a winter visit to New York City in 1902 gave her an idea. What if the operator could clear his windshield from inside the trolley without opening either a window or door? Anderson began working on a prototype right away, envisioning a wooden arm edged with rubber. When pulled, a lever inside the car triggered a spring mechanism that dragged the wiper across the windshield's surface, clearing it of any obstruction. On November 10, 1903, she was issued a U.S. patent number 743801 for her window cleaning device, the first windshield wipers. Mary Anderson's life before windshield wipers. Anderson was born on an Alabama plantation in 1866. Although her father died when she was just 4 years old, Anderson grew up with the privilege of financial stability from the estate he left behind. Little is known about her life before 1889, when she moved with her widowed mother and sister Fanny to the rapidly industrializing city of Birmingham. There, the family entered the real estate business, financing and building the Fairmont Apartments on Highland Avenue. It was a first step for Anderson into a male-dominated business world. Over the following years, she became more deeply involved in local property development and management. In 1893, she moved to Fresno, California to operate a cattle ranch and vineyard. That venture was apparently short-lived, however. Soon, Anderson had returned home to the Fairmont Apartments to help care for her ailing aunt. When her aunt passed, her secret stockpiles of gold and jewelry, hidden in trunks in the family, was forbidden to open while she lived, helped to fund Anderson's entrepreneurship, including the invention of the first windshield wipers. Why are there fewer female inventors? Anderson never married and, like the female inventors who came before and after her, faced different constraints to entrepreneurship than men, such as prohibitions on owning property and opening bank accounts. Today, women still only account for 12% of U.S. patent holders, which suggests there are more factors at play, says Zarina Khan, professor of economics at Bowdoin College. The most significant reasons relate to choices rather than obstacles, Zarina explains. First, the kinds of technology that are patentable do not align with the kinds of technology that women choose to create. Second, patents enable markets in ideas and are not as useful if the creator does not wish to sell their idea or commercialize their inventions. Mary Anderson couldn't sell her windshield wiper idea. Anderson, for her part, did want to sell her window cleaning device. For at least a year and a half, she hawked her invention to manufacturers in the fledgling motor vehicle industry. Each responded with some variation of the rejection sent by Montreal firm Dinning and Eckenstein on June 20, 1905. We regret to state that we do not consider the window cleaning device to be of such commercial value as would warrant our undertaking its sale. Not was it only that Anderson's invention was considered unworthy of investment in a car industry that had yet to take off. Some argued the window cleaning device was downright dangerous, its sweeping motion a distraction for the driver, deemed somehow worse than being unable to see through the windshield at all. Anderson never found a buyer, something her descendants believe may have in part been due to her status as an independent, unmarried woman without a father. That windshield wipers are now found on virtually every motor vehicle around the world suggests something else, too. Anderson was ahead of her time. When cars got windshield wipers. 5 years after Mary Anderson was issued her patent, car maker Henry Ford introduced his Ford Model T. 5 years later, Ford introduced the moving assembly line, an innovation which drastically lessened the time it took to build the car and greatly reduced its cost to consumers. As cars became ubiquitous across the U.S., manufacturers' eyes were opened to the value of the windshield wiper. By the early 1920s, a version of Anderson's invention became standard on most vehicles. Anderson likely never earned any royalties or licensing fees since her U.S. patent number 743801 expired in 1920. Indeed, car manufacturers didn't use her exact design. Other female inventors followed Anderson, including Charlotte Bridgewood, the purported inventor of the first electrically powered automatic windshield wiper in 1917, who improved on Anderson's original idea. Mary Anderson lived long enough to see windshield wipers become an essential feature of millions of cars and buses around the world, though not long enough to see herself inducted into the National Inventors Hall of Fame in 2011. Anderson remained an indefatigable businesswoman throughout her life, managing the Fairmont Apartments until her death at the age of 87. Odds are owning a car outfitted with the wiper successor of her 1903 invention. ...93% success rate shown in an experimental sleep apnea procedure. From Science Alert, February 9, 2026, by David Neild. Obstructive sleep apnea, a breathing disorder where the airway becomes blocked during sleep, comes with numerous health risks and dangers, but a potential new treatment could make a real difference to the millions of people affected worldwide. The new approach, described in a study by researchers at Flinders University in Australia, builds on an existing treatment called hypoglossal nerve stimulation, HNS. The hypoglossal nerve controls the tongue, and HNS uses electrical pulses to prevent the tongue from blocking the throat. However, as it stands today, HNS requires surgery and a relatively bulky implant. It's invasive and time-consuming. It also doesn't work for everyone. Here, researchers wanted to test a smaller electrode that's easier to insert and manage. Bottom line, it worked. In brief stimulation trials lasting several breaths, the new HNS electrode effectively opened the airway on 13 out of 14 participants tested, a 93% success rate. In some cases, it was even successful when the breathing had stopped completely. The early signs are that this is a substantial upgrade for HNS. It's a 90-minute procedure performed under ultrasound guidance with minimal discomfort, says otolaryngologist Simon Carney from Flinders University. Importantly, we were able to open airways in patients previously considered unsuitable for HNS. While the approach will need further development and testing before it can be used more widely, ultimately it promises an HNS treatment option that could be implanted through a short procedure in a clinic rather than via more invasive surgery with its associated risks at a hospital. That means it would be an option for more people with obstructive sleep apnea, OSA. Eligible patients could be seen more quickly and would have less recovery time than with surgery. Currently, HNS is largely effective, but not always, and the researchers say their new version could be tailored more precisely for individuals. Being a less invasive procedure, it should be easier to tweak. HNS isn't actually the first line of treatment against OSA, though. That's something called continuous positive airway pressure, or CPAP. This beats HNS in its results overall, but it involves wearing a mask over the mouth during sleep to keep the airway open. It's a rather awkward setup, despite its effectiveness. And about half of patients find they're able to tolerate CPAP and stick with it. That's where HNS comes in, and the new and improved version that the researchers have tested here. This approach may reduce recovery time and costs while improving success rates for people who cannot tolerate conventional treatments, says physiologist and lead author Amal Osman from Flinders University. The team says their next steps are to develop this approach so it can be used safely and practically in the long term and integrated with wearable technologies. other nerves and muscles could potentially be targeted to improve airflow as well. It's worth noting that this was a study carried out in a sleep lab with a relatively small group of people with OSA. The initial findings are very encouraging, but the technique needs to be tested with more people and in more natural settings. Whether it's reducing the risk of cognitive decline in people with OSA or simply helping them to feel less tired throughout the day, improved treatments could make a major difference, and this new take on HNS is off to an encouraging start. Our goal is to give patients more choices and better outcomes, says Danny Eckert from Flinders University. This study shows that with innovation and the right tools, sleep apnea treatment can become more accessible, comfortable, personalized, and effective. In a rare event, the moon got a massive new crater. The crater is 225 meters wide, a size expected only once in every 139 years. In Science News, by Lisa Grossman, March 23, 2026. A once-in-a-century crater formed on the moon right under our noses. A routine search of images from NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter camera found a fresh crater as wide as two American football fields. Planetary scientist Mark Robinson reported March 17 at the Lunar and Planetary Sciences meeting in the Woodlands, Texas. The crater is 225 meters wide and formed in April or May of 2024. Robinson said, according to predictions based on other lunar landmarks, a crater that big should form only once in 139 years. The discovery can help highlight the risks impacts posed to future astronauts. One of the first craters the orbiter spotted after it began its mission in 2009 was 70 meters wide, said Robinson of Houston-based space flight company Intuitive Machines. I used to joke with folks that now the bar has been set. You have to find a 100-meter crater, he said. Now, lo and behold, we have 225 meters. The crater seems to have formed on a boundary between the cratered and craggy lunar highlands and a wide, flat mare which formed from liquid magma pooling on the moon's surface. Its depth, about 43 meters on average, and its steep edges suggest it formed in strong material like solidified lava, but its shape is slightly elongated, which suggests the ground beneath the crater is not all the same, Robinson said. The crater is also surrounded by a bright blanket of ejecta, rock and dust that splashed out in all directions when the impact occurred. That extends hundreds of meters from the rim. Robinson and colleagues found other disturbances as far as 120 kilometers from the crater. That could be bad news for future moon bases. Bits of rock ejected from impacts could hit lunar habitats at high speeds from very far away. Buildings would need to be designed to survive that. You've got to protect your assets to withstand small particles hitting you at order of magnitude a kilometer per second, Robinson said. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you'd like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm David Jaffe. Thank you for listening.
Listen to Audio Journal on your smart speaker. Just say, Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn. Or, hey Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn.
Hello listeners, would you like to hear news from Holden, Paxton, Princeton, Rutland, and Sterling that you're not likely to hear on commercial television and radio? Tune in to Audio Journal every Friday at 7 a.m. and again at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.